Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. Since the dawn of recorded time, some of the greatest monuments, mausoleums, and other mighty works of mankind have appeared on a list of wonders of the world. And like the seas, days of the week, or deadly sins, there are always seven of them. In ancient times, the seven wonders included hanging gardens, temples, and a lighthouse. A list of more modern wonders has on it the Empire State Building, the Taj Mahal, and the Great Wall of China. The seven engineering wonders of the world include the Panama Canal and the London sewage system. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? That's the question I ask my guests in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is the comedian, writer, and broadcaster David Baddiel. Over several decades, David has achieved great success in a career, or perhaps that's better described as three or four careers, spanning several aspects of writing and performing. From the late 1980s onwards, David has appeared on stage and screen as a comedian, on his own, or in collaboration, first with Rob Newman, later with Frank Skinner, with whom he created their fantasy football TV show. With Frank and the Lightning Seeds, he's to be found at the top of the charts, most years when England nearly, but don't quite, manage to win a major football tournament. More recently, David has written a number of best-selling children's books and has published several adult, by which I mean grown-up, novels as well. He wrote the screenplay for a film starring Omid Jalili, which he later turned into a stage musical. His recent one-man shows have explored his family history, fame, and metaphysics, as well as the Twitterverse and the abuse to be found on the wonderful World Wide Web. But do you look at the world with a sense of wonder, David? You certainly explore lots of different things.
Hello, Clive.
Hi, David.
Do I look at the world with wonder? It's actually a major issue for me. In when you said metaphysics, I assume you're referring to my play, God's Dice, which was on stage just before the pandemic and was due to transfer to the West End, and then the pandemic screwed that up. And
actually, I didn't mean to cause you pain by bringing that up. Sorry.
No, but it was actually a very central thing in that play, because the play is really written from my own point of view as a sort of extreme atheist. But as an extreme atheist, I often talk to sort of either religious or semi-religious or agnostic people, and they talk about, but what, you know, where is your sense of wonder? What makes you, do you have any sense of the miraculous? And I don't want to give away anything about my seven wonders, but that play was to some extent an investigation of whether or not there is an equivalent of the religious miraculous in science, whether the way that science has gone over the last sort of, well, my sort of lay understanding of it over the last sort of 60 years, particularly with quantum physics, is whether or not there's actually things that happen at that level that you would think, well, that's basically God, isn't it?
Yeah, or at any rate, extraordinary.
Yeah,
or wonderful.
Yeah, but in terms of the smaller things in life, constantly I'm assailed by how wonderful life is.
Well, I think you're anticipating perhaps one of the bigger topics that you come from, the bigger wonders. But perhaps you can start with your first wonder. What's that?
Well, that is sort of what I was just saying about being assailed by how very ordinary things in life can be wonderful. My favourite writer, John Updike, once said that it is the job of art to give the mundane its beautiful due. And my first choice is cats.
Now, some of your wonders, which I've got a list of, have surprised me. Not so much this one, because I do know you're a cat owner, cat lover. Yeah. How many cats do you have at the moment, for example?
I have three at the moment. It's a mum and two of her children. Unfortunately, she had a teenage pregnancy and gave birth to nine overall. We found good homes for seven of them and kept two of them, who she mainly now punches. I mean, she's not a good mum, I have to say. She looks furiously at them like, what are you doing here? And then hits them a lot. But the reason I chose cats, I perhaps should start with a baseline thing, is I have had cats ever since I was a kid. When I grew up, we had a cat called Fomfer. My dad called the cat Fomfer. It was a sort of, my dad often made up names for everything, often in a kind of slightly Jewish but slightly Welsh way. That's who he was, a Jewish Welsh person. And the cat used to purr a lot. And he used to pick her up and say, "Are you fomfering?" Which is a kind of onomatopoeic word for purring, I guess.
Is that Welsh or Yiddish?
Both. I think it's a bit of both. Although when she had a child, when Fomf had a child, he named the child Ben Fimfling Fomf, which is definitely Yiddish. Anyway... I think from a very early age, like, if I was to psychoanalyze, I would say my dad in particular was not an emotional man. My dad was not a loving, you know, affectionate dad. He was mainly cross, mainly angry. I remember when the phone rang in my house when I was young, my dad would always go, "Oh, fucking hell." He would always just be furious that the phone had rung. No
Who's
sense.
That now?
No sense that it might be, you know, a positive thing, just always angry. And about the one thing that would show any kind of softness, not his children, with my dad, was the cat. You know, that's the one place where I would see my dad being a sort of sweet, affectionate, physical man, because he would pick the cat up and, you know, all stroke it and be really nice to it. And I think that's where I developed this kind of idea that cats are beautiful. I mean, incredibly kind of beautiful and objects of affection. And that has stuck with me. I think I then started to transfer quite a lot of probably the affection that I probably should have felt for my parents to the cat. And throughout my life, even when I was at university, I took in a street cat in the, you know, well before a street cat named Bob, I had a cat called Jezebel, who I took in my halls of residence and used to somehow find food for illegally. It would have been, you know, people would have got cross about it if they'd known. And I've always just always had cats and always felt I can't really call a house a home without a cat.
And you're probably handing this on to your children as a...
Totally, yes. My children, certainly my daughter particularly, is very obsessed with cats. But within that, the cat that we have now, the mum who I referred to earlier, is called Pip. And here's another interesting thing I think about cats is Pip is very, very obsessed with Dolly.
Your daughter.
Yeah, Dolly's my daughter. Pip loves Dolly. She sort of hates me, although that depends slightly on where we are in the house. She sort of likes me upstairs but hates me downstairs, which is true. I'm a much nicer person upstairs, but she loves Dolly whatever, and acts like a dog around her. It's like unbelievably affectionate, all the rest of it. But what I'm interested in again is I think people who don't like cats imagine that cats are very sort of monotonous in terms of their personality. They're just all very high flown and standoffish or whatever. But actually, I've had a lot of cats, and within a small palette of expression and kind of behavior, they've all been very distinct characters. I mean, really distinct characters. And I still think about ones that I have had in the past. I recently, about 3 years ago, had to put down for the first time. It was kind of a weird thing. Like, I've had all these cats. I've never actually had to put one down. They've either died of natural causes or they've disappeared or sadly been run over or whatever. Monkey, who was a cat I had for 20 years and did a weird thing, which was when I was first going out with Morwenna Banks, who is now my wife, I gave her a cat, which she'd never had a cat before. And clearly it was me. It was like a stalky thing to do because it's sort of saying, right, we're going to be together for a long time.
Oh, yes.
Isn't it?
Cats have a deep psychological significance for you, David. This is emerging. Can I just bring it back to the mundane? Because we mustn't spend too much time on yak cats, but just the mundane level, can I just put, as an interest of, you know, balance, cats can also be tiresome things. They scratch your furniture. They kill blue tits. They bring half-alive mice into the house and torture them to death in front of you. Sometimes they dispose of their waste materials in inconvenient ways. Do any of those things ever get to you and make you say, "I don't know why I like cats so much. Get out of my life," just as a, you know, expression.
No,
of anger. No,
never. I feel that they're the run up for me to children, because children have got lots and lots of negative things. But when you have them, you accept that they do almost all of those things you describe, certainly as regards waste products. Admittedly, none of my children have tortured mice. And if they did, I would think, shit, I've given birth to Ted Bundy. But none of them have done that. But they are, you know, you'll know this. often very tiresome children. And yet you don't think, I wish I never had them. You sort of accept that as part and parcel of the deal. And I think I felt that with cats. I would say, upsetting whoever's listening to this who may be a dog person, that on the rare occasions when I've had to look after a dog, that's what I felt about dogs. So, for example, I was once just in this house, and someone who was living in the opposite house had three Labrador puppies. They were so sweet, so lovely, and brought them over for me to play with and my kids, who loved it. Within 10 minutes, I just thought, go away, take these terrible things that are just over me all the time and in my face away. I would feel that about dogs. So cats, that's my first wonder.
People say that you choose a dog, but the cat chooses you. And people say that cats are aloof. Well, I don't know about that. All I know is that the bee, our beloved cat, was much more than a pet. He was a friend. We loved him dearly. And, you know, I think he loved us dearly too.
The second on the list that I've got that you sent over is sour sweets. And this is not, I wouldn't say it's a surprise, but it's certainly not one. I wasn't expecting you to put sour sweets on your list of wonders of the world. Now, are you talking about Maynard sours or that
sort
of
thing? Yes, I'm talking about sweets, as in confectionery, that is not just sweet, but also sour. And when I was a kid, oh God, I've gone back to it again. There was a newsagent near Dollis Hill Station, near where I lived. And if I had 5 pence, I would go in there and ask for these apple drops that in my mind, even though I have had apple drops since that don't match up to this, were extremely sour. And I don't know whether this is correct or not, but I believe that some people have a palate that likes sour, that like 5 to 10% of people, even though sour is kind of a negative word, that actually some people really like sour. And it may interest you to know that I once contacted Innocent, the drinks people. I contacted them and said, have you not thought about doing a range of sour drinks? So, you know, because there are, in confectionery, there is, this is like a pitch I'm doing now, something like 10% of the confectionery market is things called things like Toxic Sour Atom Bomb. Sound really horrible, but in fact, they pride themselves, brand themselves on being as sour as possible. And I thought, well, if they could do it in sweets, they should be able to do it in drinks. And maybe the way to do the drinks is to be a bit less toxic atom bomb sour and a bit more sort of nice sour. So
you could do sour apple drink or
Sour apple, sour orange, sour whatever. And I said, I even, you know what, Clive? I even had a way of doing it, which was add lemon juice. Add lemon juice to your orange juice or to your apple juice, and that'll make it sour. And I do this at home all the time. I will buy cloudy lemonade from Sainsbury's. It will be far too sweet because those things are far too sweet. And I do think there has been a creeping up of the amount of sugar and sweetness in, you know, processed food. And I'll pour lemon juice into it, and that will make it incredibly nicer and less horribly sickly sweet. But what I think I want at the heart of this, and still occasionally buy as a man in his 50s, which is odd, is actual confectionery. I have one over there called, I think it's called something breakers, ice breakers, and they are sour sweets, and they are just sweets which they've added probably very bad chemicals to that are also sour. But in my book, The Death of Eli Gold, which was my last adult book before I switched to writing children's books.
Yes, a fine book. I think
there's three pages. I could go and read something now about sour sweets, about the guy, clearly in this case, a version of me, Harvey, arriving at New York airport and not being able to think straight unless he gets some sour sweets. He treats them essentially like heroin. And there's a sort of balance to the world that comes to him in the balance of sour and sweet that he gets while sucking on a sour sweet.
How did you get on? You said you wrote to Innocent and you've perhaps considered writing to Haribo and Maynard's, and they're all probably owned by the same company now. But I found in my suggestions that I've ever made to commercial, they're not interested. They don't want to have suggestions made.
Well, I mean, this is a bit of a mental suggestion. I mean, I have really suggested. I spoke to someone from Unilever about this once because they make all sorts of sweets. And then I wrote to someone, and clearly the bloke at Innocent who got this email at some level, he's thinking, this is funny. David Baddiel's written to me about some weird idea about sweets. So he gave it the time of day for that reason. I got quite a lot of emails back from him. But the problem is, I think, at the end of the day, it's not really an idea. Well, it's hard to know how I can – it's not something I can patent, really. It's really a branding idea. And if I worked in the confectionery stroke fruit drinks, you know, market – I think I'd be quite proud of going to my CEO and saying, look, I've got a whole idea for a whole new range, a whole new brand. But as somebody who isn't that, it's quite hard for it to land on their email tray with, like, this is an amazing idea.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It doesn't feel...
I once spent some time with an inventor, not of sour sweets, but, you know, invented lots of interesting engineering things, made a lot of money out of it. And he explained to me one of the principle of these things. He had another idea. He said, well, it's not going to happen. He's too old. He said, well, but the thing is, there's two things, as with all things in life. There's the inventing it, the idea, and then there's the doing it. And if you don't do it, you have to do it yourself. Start the company, manufacture. That's the only way to do it. Because that, the best you're going to get, you'll give your idea away. You're certainly not convince anybody else to do your idea.
Yes, well, I think someone said that to me. I think what you need to do is run a stall. You need to actually make it yourself using fruit juice and then go and run a stall. And at that point, I thought, yeah, I'm okay. I'm fine. I'm not going to do that, am I? Because that sounds really hard work and cold.
Well, without wanting to track back into your childhood again, because I think we'll be returning to that, but I think both your parents, for different stages of life, didn't sell sweets, but sold different things on stall. So you might have been, you know, call upon some experience there if you were observing what they were doing and absorbing any of it, but perhaps you were ignoring
that's
it.
That's true. Well, my dad sold Dinky Toys. My dad was made redundant from Unilever. He was made redundant from Unilever in his 40s and eventually couldn't get another job as a scientist, which is what he was trained to do, and so sold Dinky Toys, which was his hobby, in Gray's Antique Market. And then opposite him, my mum set up a stall selling golf memorabilia, which anyone who has followed my career closely, she only did because she was having an affair with a golfing memorabilia salesman, and that had made her obsessed with golf. So some would say that was a bit of a difficult thing for my dad to have to face every day at work, but they made it, you know, function somehow.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
Can I trouble you for a quarter pound of licorice also?
Trouble me, sir? Trouble me? Nothing's too much trouble in this shop, sir.
Only thing is, I don't like the pink ones.
Oh, no.
And I don't like the blue ones.
You don't like the blue ones?
No.
I see, sir. I have to take out the blue ones, yep. Shall we, sir? That's it.
Not the black and white ones either, please. I don't want the black.
You don't want the black and white ones? No. Oh, well, that only leaves the orange ones, I'm afraid, sir.
Yes, but I only like the orange
ones. Oh, you only like the orange. I'll tell you what we'll do. Then we'll take them all out of the can, sir.
Well, we're going to come back to your father and family later, but it's interesting that even sour sweets has led us back there. Can you let us know your third wonder, please, David?
So my third one, I mean, this is just a thing that I'm fascinated by, which is goose pimples, particularly the fact that they come up on your flesh when you listen to music or sometimes a line of poetry or even just when you're watching a film and something sad happens. You get this weird physical reaction.
There's a name for it. That's ASMR. Are you familiar with the stuff that happens with ASMR now?
Is that the thing? But isn't that the thing on the internet where people whisper in your ear?
Yes, it's autonomous sensory meridian response. And I was just raising that because I'm not sure if it's the same thing or just a related thing. People now induce goose pimple or that sort of feeling by looking at people wrapping packaging or stroking cloth or even doing ironing, which is, you know, would you say that's the same thing or just as a related?
Well, I've tried that. I've tried the ASMR.
ASMR, yeah.
Yeah, I've listened to some with headphones, some of those videos, and some of it involve quite attractive women whispering in your ear, which is quite a nice thing, but not that, doesn't do that much for me. And then they do tend to do things like, here's a brush and I'm going to brush it near your ear. or I don't know about ironing, but yeah, sort of very sort of little mundane tasks. That doesn't particularly work for me, but I can see how it might. It feels to me like that is inducing it in a slightly contrived way. And what is wonderful about the goose pimple response is that it is not contrived. It happens spontaneously. You know, often as I get older, so I haven't really thought about this, but often as I get older, it's linked with nostalgia, I think. So something that calls to mind something very to do with my childhood or something that I remember and have always... So for example, right, when I was a teenager, I thought I liked art films very much. And I think The Draftsman's Contract by Peter Greenaway was my favourite film. I was that much of a...
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if you can use that word. And I went... in a kind of sneery way with some student friends to see E.T. And I remember thinking at the time, oh, this will be rubbish, but, you know, we can laugh about it. And I absolutely, I've never been so moved by a film in my life. I still don't think I've been so moved by a film in my life. It sort of burst a dam in my soul about how a film like that, a sort of film that tries to emotionally manipulate you, but does it so skillfully, just is so moving. Anyway, at the end of that film, as you may or may not remember, there's a bit where E.T. has to leave. Sorry, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it. E.T. has to leave to go home, and he says to Elliot, the child who he's become friendly with and who they've had these many adventures with, Elliot says he doesn't want him to go, and E.T. raises his finger to Elliot's forehead and says, I'll be right here. And as I'm saying it, I can feel goose pimples rising on my flesh. And that is partly because I think the thing that induces goose pimples most often in me is a kind of happy, sad thing, like something that is half happy, half sad, but also because it's now mixed up with my memories of watching E.T. when I was young. And the bringing of that back and how I felt at the time creates its own kind of goose pimple response.
And your realization at that time that however much you like the Draftsman contract, it's not going to have the same impact on the world as E.T. And, you know, you'd have to seek it out now to watch it, where people could have watched E.T. dozens of times just by it cropping up on the telly over all that time.
Yeah. I mean, it's often, I've got quite a hefty, although I hope hopefully economic, liking for sentimentality, it turns out. When it's kind of like in those films, like, for example, there's a moment in Edward Scissorhands where at the end of Edward Scissorhands, it's revealed again, spoiler alert, that the Winona Ryder girl figure is telling this story about the incredible Edward Scissorhands character to her granddaughter. Right. And the granddaughter says, do you ever see him again? She says only when it snows. And then she says, sometimes you can still see me dancing in it. And it cuts to her young dancing in the snow. And I was in tears when I saw that. And by then I was completely committed to like, oh, I like these kind of films, these sort of fantasy sort of films with sentimental moments. But I watched that film with Dennis Leary, who you will know.
Oh, yes.
He's a comedian, very hard-bitten yes. American comedian.
Yes. Yeah.
And I came out and I remember Dennis saying, ah, that was shit. That was shit. Especially that line, you can still see me dancing in it. That was fucking terrible. And I had to pretend that I didn't like it. But in fact, I was goose pimpling all over.
Come. Stay.
Let's continue in that theme, perhaps, with your fourth wonder.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this is, I guess it's in a way, it's sentimental, but it's also an actual wonder, I think. So my father has dementia. He now has very advanced dementia. He doesn't know who I am. I mean, he sort of recognizes that I'm someone familiar to him, but he wouldn't know what my name is. He would be confused. I mean, and he's confused sometimes when I say I'm your son, because I think he thinks, but you're 56 or whatever you are, you're an old man. And I think because my dad isn't looking at himself in the mirror, I think he thinks he's about, I know he does. He thinks he's about 27. He's in fact 86. And so he's got advanced dementia, and people who do know my work will know that was originally diagnosed as Pick's disease, which is a frontal lobe dementia that causes the symptoms include things like swearing and obscenity and disinhibition and laziness and anger. And when the neurologist first told me that list of symptoms, I said, sorry, does he have a disease or have you just met him? Because my dad was always exactly like that. So it was quite hard to know that he had it, except he became very extreme in his behaviours. He's not really like that anymore. He still occasionally is very truculent, but most of the time he's just very quiet. And yet, my dad did biochemistry for his PhD. That's when he worked for Unilever. He was working in a laboratory. And if you say to my dad, what's the chemical symbol for salt, for sodium chloride, he will say NaCl. If you say, what's the chemical symbol for lead, he will say Pb. I gave him the other day his PhD because I found it in his house. I mean, I can't even tell you, Clive, this PhD is something like on the relationship between fluoride hydrocarbons and gaseous blah, blah. I mean, it's some incredibly complex reaction. I can't read more than two sentences without thinking, right, I haven't understood. My dad was devouring it, except he didn't know it was by him. My dad is reading this incredibly difficult book. And then I said, who wrote that? And he said, I don't know. I've just started it. He's like five pages in, right? And I said, well, if you look here, and then he would look down and he said, oh, it's by me. And that, I felt a bit bad about that because I thought, oh, that I don't like to confuse him. And he clearly was confused by that, although he will forget about it 5 seconds later. But that was much more confusing for him than the incredibly confusing chemical stuff in the book. So
it's the fact that he can remember all that learning is still within him, even though he can't remember that you must have grown up to be a middle-aged or old man by now and is not still.
Well, he can't remember his son. He can't remember either any of his sons. He can't remember something that, you know, a lot of stuff. I mean, including a lot of his long-term memory is gone. People talk about dementia, meaning that, you know, oh, you can't remember the immediate stuff. But to be honest with you, like my dad lived in America for a bit and I asked him about that. He couldn't remember living in America. But he can remember, a lot of chemical and scientific things. I mean, interesting, we talked about chess earlier. About 2 years ago, I played him at chess. And as long as he was focused on the board and didn't look elsewhere and forget that he was playing chess, he was able to sort of make the next move. The other thing he can remember, I did a documentary about my dad for Channel 4. And there was, a very moving bit at the end of that where, because he gets worse actually throughout that documentary. And there's a bit at the end of that where what we're trying to get my dad to do, me and my brother, is some of his regular insults. Because my dad, the other thing he can remember are his regular insults. So still, when you leave my dad, if you say, I'm off, he will say, you've been off for years. And it's really comforting that he can still abuse you in this way. And we're sitting in a pub with him in that documentary, and we're sort of nudging him to do something like that, me and my brother Ivor. And then eventually I say, have you got a match? And he says, yes, your face and my ass. And it's unbelievably moving because it's kind of like, oh, God, he's still in there. So basically what I'm talking about is the wonder of shards of memory still being in there in a man without memory.
Well, that's fascinating. I suppose we can all slightly relate without having necessarily dementia that it is strange that you can remember things from a long time ago, even though you can't remember where you put your car keys. But this is obviously beyond that. You said it was diagnosed as Pick's disease. Has it moved on to a different diagnosis now? Is that
it hasn't got an official other diagnosis, but Pick's disease is a frontal lobe dementia, which has got mainly behavioural issues. I mean, obviously it does involve memory loss as well, but most people think of Pick's disease as, you know, antisocial behaviour issues. Whatever is happening in my dad's brain, he doesn't do much of that anymore. He's mainly just now sits in a chair and doesn't say much. So I don't think he'd get that diagnosis now.
The striking thing that relates to you in this, David, is that you did a stage show, a highly successful stage show, about your father and his condition and his background and your mother and the long-term affair that she had. And, you know, it was an entertaining, it was an interesting show for the audience, but not everybody would choose to be quite so open about the relationships and let's just call them troubles of their parents and family life. Are you just super comfortable about talking about this sort of thing?
Yeah, I am. And I think possibly too comfortable at some level. My tendency, I think Nora Ephron said that her mother had always said to her, everything is copy. And Nora Ephron, in her work, talks about sometimes learning that maybe some things aren't copy because she felt she used too much of her own family material in her work. And my sense is that I want to talk about almost anything that happens to me, no matter how it might seem uncomfortable. For me, it's made more comfortable, however uncomfortable it is, in the process of talking about it on stage or whatever. But with my parents in that show, which is called My Family, Not a Sitcom, there was some very specific stuff going on, which was I felt that both of them, by my mother's death and by my father's dementia, were being erased as people. That I was at my mother's funeral and listening to people say what a wonderful woman she was and thinking, well, you didn't know her. And saying she was wonderful is just what everyone says when people die. So if I want to have my mother in any way remembered as a real person, you have to talk about her in 360 degrees. And one of the biggest things in my mother's life was that she was in love with this golfing memorabilia salesman and transformed our life over to golf. And the thing is, if you talk about her like that, what happens is she comes alive. However much some people might say, oh, you're being negative about her, I don't recognize that. I just think I'm being true about her in a very, very specific way. And what that makes her is alive, at least in the moment on stage.
But some people might have, and I'm not really pressing you on this, it's just interesting. Some people might have chosen to write a novel in which you create a fictional character with some of these characteristics, or a play, and both of those things, in effect, you've done. So you could have chosen a different route rather than saying this was what actually happened to my mother, or what this is what she did. You could have had this character called, you know, something different.
Well, that's true. Well, actually, in Time for Bed, my first novel, both my parents do turn up as slightly different characters. And that actually really pissed my mother off, that particular book. She told my brother she thought it was shit. Whereas actually this more mature work, My Family, Not the Sitcom, even though she's dead, I know absolutely my mum would have loved that piece of work because, well, I mean, the here's a sentimental thing again, but when I first did that show, the premiere, which was at the Chocolate Factory in London, there were lots of critics in the audience, and I used to do a Q&A at the end of that show, and I came on and all these critics had their hands up, and there were important people in the room, but I decided, no, I'm going to speak first of all, even though he didn't have his hand up, to my older brother, who I've mentioned already, Ivor, who was sitting there, and he had said to me, are you sure you should be doing this, like 3 months before, and I said yeah, and he said okay, well, I'll just have to trust you on it, and I said, Ivor, what did you think? And he said, I loved it. And then he said, I loved it because it felt like she was in the room, and that was my purpose, I guess. My purpose was to make her a real person again, and so it comes from a place of love, and once you do that, I think you can sort of talk about anything.
David Baddiel's 82-year-old father, Colin, suffers from Pick's disease, a rare type of dementia which can make sufferers rude or impulsive.
All right, I'm going to sit here, Colin.
Is it nice to see David?
What am I supposed to do, smile?
I do get a lot of abuse, but then so does everyone.
You're a idiot, total tit.
So what do you two normally do when you hang out together?
This. We sit around, he abuses me.
The film The Trouble with Dad focuses on the relationship between Baddiel, his brother Ivor, and their father.
What are you doing?
Shaving your beard.
That's all we want. Doesn't hurt. Ooh, lovely. Look at that.
That's it. He's done. Where's customer?
What
right? Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This week at Sukarnov.
On the Luke and Pete Show, Luke introduced me to some bizarre animal warfare.
In the 70s, there was a... I can't remember to say this, but I promise you it's true. There was a war, an actual war, between rival chimpanzee clans that went on for over 4 years.
Meanwhile, on abroad in Japan, Chris is facing off against a natural disaster.
So the same day that I'd run out of fuel, right, I was like, well, I made it in one piece. Thank you, God. And then, like, 5 hours later, the worst earthquake I've ever experienced. It was a 15-storey building shaking from side to side. It went on so long, I was like, this hotel's coming down, and I don't want to be in it when it does.
Listen to Abroad in Japan and the Luke and Pete Show, available on your favourite podcast player.
All that and a whole lot more at Sukarnov.
So, David, thus far we've had cats, sour sweets, goose pimples, and your dad's incredible memory. So what's next?
Well, the next one relates to being on stage, so it sort of follows, and it's the sound of a big laugh in response to a new bit of material. And I'm mentioning it again, like, as I say, I did write all these down at a specific moment, so there will be a specific thing that happened quite recently that made me think of this, and it is, I don't know if you've seen this, but there's a documentary about the Comedy Store. The LA Comedy Store on Sky Documentaries or something.
I haven't seen it, but I'm obviously familiar with the place. Yeah,
yeah. Well, there's a guy. There's a 5-part documentary by a guy called Mike Binder. It's a good documentary, but there's one bit where all the comedians in a montage talk about this thing, which I'd never really completely thought about before, which is that there is a very specific joy that comes with trying out a new bit of material and it working. And then and they all talk about it. And then one woman says something very true. She says, and to be honest with you, every time you do it after that, it's not as good.
No.
It's diminishing returns every time you do it after that. Once you know it works, it's not as exciting. And that is definitely true. And, they, you know, if... I mean, I'm someone who, you know, as I grow older, particularly, even though I've, you know, done 3 big shows in the last few years, whatever, I don't know how much longer I'm going to carry on performing, because performing is, I don't know how you might feel about it, but live performing can sometimes feel like, oh, it's kind of a young man's game. And it's kind of hard work, and certainly touring and all the rest of it. And when I was doing My Family Not the Sitcom, which was a very, you know, emotional show and very kind of important to me in terms of what it was talking about, I got very anxious about it not being new anymore to me. I mean, see, thinking like, okay, this is now quite successful. I'm doing it. I'm doing 2 West End runs. I'm doing it in Australia, wherever else I'm doing it. And I don't know if it feels new to me anymore. But what I mean then is I'm no longer feeling emotionally connected as I was before, because it feels like I'm just rehearsing something. At the same time, I'm also saying, I'm not getting that moment where I'm just trying out a new bit and it's really working. And I don't know if non-comedians know about that. So I sort of threw it in as just as something that...
It is interesting. I mean, in relation to your particular show, when it is so personal, it's about your life, I think that's a particular thing where in your 500th performance and your eyes are welling up when recalling your mother is going to be different. For when you've just, I mean, I would say I think I am capable of thinking, if you do a joke and it goes really well and you think, oh, that's great. Oh, but it just relates to the funny way the stage is set up and the man coming in at that moment. That's just for now. I'm going to have to hope something like that happens at another performance. But when you'd make a joke and you think, oh, that's good. That's good. That could do again.
Yes. No, that's true. That's true. I mean, but that's interesting, isn't it? Because
that might be the equal and opposite emotion that I'm expressing. Ooh, that's good.
No, but you're right, though, because the crack, as it were, the sort of like addictive quality of doing a joke that works is, as a working comedian, based on the fact that, oh, I'll be able to do that again now and again, and that's in the bank. At the same time, you know that the 500th time you tell it, you're thinking, oh, God, am I doing this joke still?
Yeah. There's jokes you do, you aren't even thinking about it because you're trying to think of the next bit, but you're sort of just on autopilot telling two or three that just, oh, I know I do, blah, 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 blah. Oh, yes, I've remembered now the topical joke I was trying to remember.
I found before when I've done jokes or a show that you're going a long time and you do get a sense of like, oh, God, I can't keep doing this material. What you tend to do is slightly self-sabotage in a way of trying to find a new way of doing it. So even though you know this joke works if I say it like this with the stress here and a gap here or whatever, you end up doing it wrong because you think, like, I've just got to find a new way of saying it. But I think the wonder thing, to come back to that, it was, you know, I think people often don't understand who, you know, I still get people saying to me, you know, why does one want to be a stand-up? You know, isn't it the most terrifying thing? And it is, it can be, but that there is a real reward and incredible. There's probably a huge dopamine, actual neurological reward. Someone should wire a stand-up up at a new material night because I think there is a real dopamine reward when you hear the laugh, particularly the first time you do a new joke.
One of the things you do a lot of, and that, again, you formed it into a show, as everything becomes a show in the end, is argue with people on the internet, on Twitter. And you've got the trolls, as they, you know, you call them, people call them, people who are rude about you. You're just kind of rude back or funny back.
Yeah.
And you've made a whole show out of that. Now, two questions I'd like to ask you about, if I may, is that how do you find time? I may have asked you this before, but I'm going to ask you.
Yeah, you have.
Well, how do you find time to be on Twitter so much, given that you're writing novels, writing children's books, preparing shows? And that's the first question. So how do you find the time?
Well, I think I would write more. I would build empires if I wasn't being distracted by the internet. I do think it's a massive distraction for a thousand reasons. I think, you know, someone said that, I think it was Dave Gorman or someone said that there are distractions all the time when you look out of the window. But at least when you look out the window, there's just some trees. Now the window that you look into, you know, there's all of life and all things are there and there's so many things to get involved in.
Well, of all those things you can get involved in, why are you looking at somebody who said, I can't stand that David Baddiel or, you know, or ruder than that, obviously, and you want to reply to them?
Well, in terms of the trolls, I don't actually do it as much as I used to, but I did it a lot at the start because it seemed to me that they were hecklers. It seemed to me that, you know, I'd done a joke or whatever, and out of nothing, a stranger from the darkness was slagging me off. And my natural response as a comedian would be to try and make that funny, to try and, you know, use what they said in a kind of, right, I'm going to build on this. I'm going to not reject it. I'm not going to get angry or any of the things that are wrong when you're dealing with a heckler. I'm going to sort of like accept what they've said and then turn it around against them. And I just did that, and it started to really work for me as, you know, because obviously there is an audience. It really works as a corollary. When you put down a heckler, the rest of the audience enjoy it and laugh at the heckler. On Twitter, I would basically say something to one of these people which made fun of them, and then I would get loads of likes from the rest of the audience, as it were, and that was a way of just creating, you know, a brand, I suppose, want of a better word for me, on Twitter. Now, I don't do it as much as I used to, partly because there are just too many trolls, and I no longer believe a lot of them are real people. I think a lot of them are state-sponsored sort of troll farm people.
Really?
Yeah, well, definitely there are. I mean, not specifically at me, but if I, you know, for example, my brother did a joke the other day which involved talking about how, you know, Christians shouldn't be so upset about Christmas. They could just choose some alternative festivals like Hanukkah or whatever. And he got loads of anti-Semitism, right? And I made a joke. I screenshotted one of them and made a joke about it. But someone said to me afterwards, oh, she seems like a nice person, because it was someone called Ashling. And I said, no, I think he seems like he's a state-sponsored troll farm worker, because he will be. It'll be some sock puppet working in some basement somewhere, spreading anti-Semitism for some weird political reason. And that's less fun for me. It's less fun than it being a real person who really hates me for real reasons.
Actually, I was talking about, the thing is that I get mistaken for lots of other people on TV, as well as having lots of lookalikes, get mistaken for lots of other people on TV, notably Ben Elton, which pisses me off a bit. But on the tour, right, when we were in Cardiff, we got a free meal from a bloke who ran an Italian restaurant because he thought I was fucking Steve Wright. Hey? Oh, well, that's a hit and run heckle, was it? Like, fuck off.
Your next wonder is something which I'll name it, because I've looked it up, but Oculus Quest is your next thing, which until I looked it up, I'd assume would be a character from Harry Potter or something. But tell me what Oculus Quest is.
Oculus Quest is a VR system, a virtual reality system, and it's a pair of goggles that I wear, not just me, lots of people wear them. I mean, I think possibly being 56 and wearing them looks more ridiculous than being younger and wearing them. But when you put them on, you can, and it's sort of very irrelevant for this particular podcast, because I sometimes go in my Oculus Quest, obviously I haven't gone anywhere, but I, using the metaphor, go to the pyramids, or to the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, if they exist, or, I don't know, to Everest. And you can go in these things. There's a particular, I can't remember what it's called now, Pano something, like on YouTube, there's a VR Pano channel called something Pano, which in extreme high definition and 360 degrees, will take you on a helicopter to, you know, an iced over 400-mile river in China. And the first time I did this, I mean, actually, interesting, there's a bit of a diminishing returns, like we've talked about before with this now, so I'm less amazed by it than I was. But the first time I did it, I had a massive goose pimple reaction. I remember, you know, going to the Statue of Jesus in Rio, in a way that, by the way, if you actually went there, would be quite hard, because it's a drone shot. So you're flying around the Statue of Christ in Rio in a way that you can see people at the base of the statue, but you yourself are, you know, happily like getting a much better view than they are, even though you're in North London.
So I understood this. So they've got presumably they filmed it using a drone or similar. But it's a point of view shot from that point of view. So you feel you're there. Do you feel as though you're floating, or is it just you're getting a good view? Or?
Yeah, I mean, not all. Sometimes, you know, you're walking around or in New York, or sometimes you're by the sea or whatever. But these ones, the Pano ones, tend to be drone shots, and you feel that your eyes are the eyes of the drone. So you just feel like you're flying very close to the whatever it might be. And they'll improve. And in fact, I've got the new one, which is slightly better than the old one. But without doubt, it doesn't feel very, I mean, I haven't been to the Statue of Christ at Rio, so perhaps what I'm seeing is complete nonsense. But it feels to me, I sometimes do go to places I have been, actually. I sometimes think, oh, right, well, I was in China. I did a documentary in China. I'll see if they've got Xi'an. And, yeah, they have. And so that helps, because you think, like, yeah, well, it really is like this. And it's a wonder. It's not a wonder, because it's just, you know, a very advanced form of television, essentially, of immersive television. And I guess that's something that you might expect would happen with the way that technology has advanced. The wonder is just when you put it on, This is very banal. You really think you're there, Clive? I'm not saying very original, anything very original here about VR, but it really does feel like it. And I mean, I guess with the pandemic, a tiny part of me, although I'm not sure this is really true, but a tiny part of me thought, well, I'm fine because I've got my Oculus Quest and I can go anywhere. And it feels a little bit melancholy maybe to say that, of like, okay, so actual travel is not going to happen anymore and going anywhere proper is not going to happen anymore. Surely it's a bit pathetic to have these goggles. But actually, when you put them on, it doesn't feel like that. It feels amazing. I mean, this feels just like an advert for Oculus Quest.
No, well, I would suggest it perhaps, I'm probably thinking to just say count our blessings or the banal, but if you just look back, let's say 100 years or 150 years before then, if you wanted to hear a piece of music, you had to go and find the musician or bring the musician to you. Now you can hear any piece of music you've ever thought about. And it took record players, and then it's in your phone. As you mentioned, television. There was a time we had no, you know, before the Second World War, there wasn't such a thing as television. And now you've got 3D, 4D, super HD telly you can watch. Oculus Quest is just the next thing, and you can be, it's a wonder at the moment. In 20 years' time, it won't be a wonder because everybody will have this, and there'll be perhaps another wonder that.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite hard.
Teleports you in some way.
Yeah, maybe. It's quite hard to know because actually, your point is right. Like with music, I've often felt that Spotify has sort of ruined music because, you know, the process whereby you had to get out a vinyl thing or whatever, even a CD, and find the track that you liked meant that you rationed your own exposure to these songs. Now, I am frankly bored of songs that I think 20 years ago, I thought I'd never be bored of because I can hear them too easily. And I've ended up sort of swimming around in this sort of mass of music, thinking that I don't even know what I like anymore. And that possibly, I've already mentioned diminishing returns, might happen with the Oculus Quest. I might be thinking this is really, really like being at the pyramids, and I'm bored of being at the pyramids now. You know, I'm bored of being at the wonders of the world because the Oculus Quest has taken me there too easily. Maybe part of the wonders of the world is it's a bit of an effort to get there. You have to buy a ticket, you have to travel for 7 hours, you have to say to a guide, look, can I get there? And they're like, well, it's quite difficult, all that stuff. And then you feel relieved and thrilled that you've got there, whereas the bloody Quest gets you there straight away. So it might be the opposite of a wonder of the world.
Now, by looking through that window, you're able to see into the world of the computer. And by wearing the helmet, you're able to see it in 3D. So down there, there's the television I was talking about, with my glass on the top. Move around, and up comes my flash new table. There it is. So everything is in the room just where I said it was.
That's your sixth wonder. Your seventh wonder, you've said you've gone for small or banal or particular things, but your seventh wonder opens it out a bit.
Yeah, well, my seventh wonder is very small. I mean, it's the smallest thing imaginable, which is quantum physics. So I became obsessed with quantum physics, and this is obviously, again, to do with my dad, I think, because when I was a kid, my dad was obsessed with science. He used to make us learn the periodic tables, in fact, which is interesting. It's just what I said earlier about him still knowing the chemical symbol for lead or whatever. He used to do these flashcards with, you know, they'd have an element on them and it would have every information about the element and we would have to remember it or whatever. And he was obsessed with science. And then when I was about 16, with quite a lot of trepidation, I said to my dad, look, I'm going to do arts subjects for A level. I'm going to do history and English and whatever. And he said, it's a waste of a brain, which is not good parenting. And also ironic because, of course, he's now got a wasted brain, but which feels harsh, but is true.
That's just come with age, though. He didn't waste his brain while he had his.
Yeah, he didn't mean brain. To waste his brain. No. But my point is that I think there's been a return of, you know, my. Whatever it was, my reaction to my dad's attempt to make me a scientist in my sort of late 40s and 50s, which is I have become, I don't know if you feel this anyway, I feel as someone who works in the arts, I always feel a tiny part of me that thinks, yeah, but obviously real cerebral work, real braininess happens in the sciences. You know, all this sort of flim-flam that we do and, you know, literature and blah, it's great, but people who are really clever, they're scientists. And I sort of do believe that. And then what I did was start reading an awful lot of lay books by people like Brian Cox about physics. And the thing about them is, what I find when I read them is I think, God, this is incredible. And I haven't quite understood it. I've nearly understood it, but I appear not to have understood it. Although Richard Feynman, the great physicist, said the thing about quantum physics is if you think you've understood it, you haven't understood it. So let me just tell you, in terms of the wondrousness, did you see God's Dice?
I've read it. That's almost the only one of your shows I haven't seen. So you can tell me anything about it, and I'll say, really, that's very good.
Okay. Okay, so in God's Dice, it opens with a physicist, a lecturer, who was played by Alan Davis in the production, talking to a class, and then a young woman, comes down, who's in the class, who he's never met before, comes down and says she's got a question for him, and she's a Christian, and the question involves... this is very complicated, but it involves the fact that if you pair two electrons or to any sort of subatomic particles, just I'm going to simplify it now.
Thank you.
That if one is spinning in one direction, the other will be spinning in the opposite direction, mm-hmm. right? Whatever happens.
Yes.
Even if you take one of those electrons and you blast it 100 million light years away, and then you make one spin in direction A, that other electron, 100 million miles away, will instantaneously be spinning in B.
Right.
Yeah? Be spinning in the opposite direction. Einstein called it spooky action at a distance. And she says that to him, and she just sort of outlines what it is. And he says, yeah, but is that your question? And she says, no, my question is, if I am to believe that, I may as well believe in God, mightn't I? Because it's a miracle. It seems like a miracle. It seems like a miracle that two particles can be communicating across light years. Whether or not it is a miracle is a moot point. But the point is that the more I found out about quantum physics, the more it became clear to me that the way that we don't understand the world at the quantum level involves us having to say something apparently magical is going on.
So it's definitely something we don't understand and is fantastically complex. But does that lead you, or should it lead anybody, to think there's another greater force at work?
No.
Benign or otherwise, that's in control of the whole thing?
No. And lots of people do, by the way. And lots of people misinterpreted my play as thinking that was the message of the play, because there's a very clever Christian who's this girl in it who uses quantum physics to kind of create a whole new idea of religion. But actually, the play is deeply atheist, and I am deeply atheist. But, for example, my friend Russell Brand, who is now become quite religious, is constantly talking about quantum physics as a way of suggesting that essentially God exists. And the mistake I would say that he is making is our understanding of the quantum world is limited, and we can only describe it in quite limited ways. And what tends to happen then is we default to ideas of the miraculous to try and describe it. And it is sort of miraculous. It's amazing what happens there. But all that is happening when people then say, so therefore some cosmic force or blah, blah must be happening, is no, what you mean is you can't quite fill in the gaps between this amazing thing happening and that amazing thing happening, this amazing cause and effect.
Well, it's just in through the ages when nobody knew what thunder and lightning was, that was explained as the action of God or the gods.
Yeah, essentially that is what it is. I mean, for example, I don't know if you know about the observer effect. Do you know what that is?
Yes, yes. Okay, the uncertainty principle, those sort of, I know the terms.
They're sort of related, but the observer effect is specifically about the fact that if a subatomic particle is knocking about somewhere, you can't say exactly where it is, but when someone observes it, you can. Suddenly you can. Suddenly a person, essentially, measuring where an electron is, it suddenly is there. And quite a lot of sort of intelligent design, slightly mystical quantum physics type people have used that to say, oh, well, clearly we have got some kind of like power with the natural world. And therefore, you know, we are being made in God's image in some way because we have able to create the universe just by measuring it. No. What it means is that our methods of measurement, that's all we can do, is understand the cloud of probability as this is where the electron is now. That doesn't mean that we have had any effect on it at all. That's just our perception.
Newtonian mechanics is foundational to physics. Modern science really is thought to spring from Newton's ideas. It was believed that using his laws, one can predict the motions of systems if you know the interactions between them. The idea of the clockwork universe sort of evolved from that.
As always, talking to you, David, it's been a fascinating discussion, which has gone off in lots of different directions. But now it's time to choose my wonder of wonders from you, which is where I pick my favourite from your list.
Okay.
Particularly difficult, I think, because they're so different. It's not going to be sour sweets, though, but I think I'll pick the sound of a big laugh in response to a new bit of material. It's something you've obviously had lots. I've heard it occasionally. thank you, David, for sharing your view of the world through the medium of your seven wonders. Thank you for joining me on this podcast.
Thank you very much, Clive. It's been a pleasure.
This is a Stakhanov production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.